Mr. Pates, you did respond that in UGBs that you thought there was room for it to go in as an overarching policy. Wondering if this objective might be the place to also reinsert the ONL and ONF lines on the district plan map, so that objective might read something along the lines of protect the quality of the outstanding natural landscapes and outstanding natural features from subdivision use and development through mapping of ONL and ONFs on the district plan map. Something along that line.
I need to reflect on wording, precise wording, but yeah, I think the principle fits.
Okay, thank you. Objective for the next one down, 3252. I raised earlier with Mr. Barr my question over exactly how you would define, while acknowledging the potential for managed and low impact change, especially with no policy to respond to. Have you got any comment on that?
One of the challenges with these sort of objectives is trying to keep them reasonably high level and flexible, but as I said earlier, also meaningful, so that is a challenging exercise. Again, I would suggest that it's in the lower order chapter, the rural chapter and the landscape chapters, that will flesh out what that really means. Certainly there could be the potential for a policy to flesh that out.
Could it be that objective could be a little bit more indicative of what is actually intended for the land that is in the rural landscape classification? At the moment it's about acknowledging things, but if it's intended that is the area where some development can occur, then maybe it should just come out and say that.
Yes, that's a fair point. Well, I mean, what we were trying to avoid in this and many other objectives and policies, I think it's been touched on previously, was using generic RMA language like avoiding, remedying, mitigating events. So
I'm happy with you. Avoiding that.
The intent for managed and low impact change, I guess, was to try and be a bit more specific and imply that in that location or within that classification, it is less sensitive. So there is the potential for low impact development, managed development. But I take your points.
Isn't it normally with reference to ability to absorb change? So would that be more clearly understood than low impact change?
Can I just check on while you're thinking about that, can I put to you that the two halves of the objective are mutually contradictory? That measured and low impact change is something different to maintaining and enhancing landscape character, unless you start talking about landscape character over a large scale.
That was the implication of my question.
Sorry.
Simple and direct.
I think that part of the character of the rural landscape classification is the fact that it has more development than some of the more protected landscapes. So for me, in my opinion, that part of the character is the fact that it does have more development. So I don't necessarily think they are in conflict with each other. I think part of the character, the landscape character, is the fact that it has and can further contain managed and low impact change. So.
And then we go to the next objective. Have you finished?
Absolutely. Sorry.
direct new urban subdivision use or development to occur in those areas which have potential to absorb change without detracting from landscape and visual amenity values. You then have taken away the UGB policy to which it was going to refer, which, to my reading, makes it pretty carte blanche and would appear to be across all zones, and you talk about ONL and ONS, and it's saying basically that you could see that, from my reading of it, that there could be urban subdivisions within ONLs and ONFs, which would, I would have thought, be against the RMA stipulation of protecting them.
So, again, that policy which I've recommended be deleted, I mean, we're now talking about potentially the urban growth boundaries in this chapter, there would be a certain logic in retaining that because, I mean, I think the main reason I took it out was that the submission is talking about replication of chapters, and that we have the urban development chapter which talks about applying UGVs as a method. But I think you could also argue that to give meaning, give effect to that objective, the policy helps in that respect because it's saying where that new urban development or subdivision should be directed, which is within the urban growth boundaries.
So if you, therefore, are you saying that perhaps we could add the words within UGB?
You're saying
you're
retaining
the
policy.
Well,
I think Mr. Page just said that he would reconsider the deletion of that policy and possibly retain it, which would be, have the effect.
That's right, because, as
of
I say...
Of UGBs, yes, but
yes.
It doesn't actually change that objective, does it? Because that objective on its own, even if you have the UGBs within it, even if you have UGBs within the Strategic Directions chapter, to my reading, that objective, without referencing UGBs,
I don't want to do all the answers for Mr. Pates, but if the policy says that that is how the objective is going to be achieved...
Oh, OK, so it is
going to be that's how it works.
OK, thank you. Accepted now. I would like to see this problem. Now to the urban development chapter. So this is... we took out... policies from Strategic Direction 3, and there was an extended transfer over to Chapter 4, but not in total. There was some changing of words, for instance, connectivity and integration with existing urban development from Chapter 3 lost the with existing urban development and became only connectivity and integration, not specifying what with. Sustainable use of public infrastructure was what it became from sustainable provision of council infrastructure. Convenient linkages versus what we had initially was integration and facilitation of efficient transport system. I didn't see in Section 32 an explanation of why those changes had occurred. And furthermore, the last three policies from 5 to 7 were taken away totally. So just wondering if you could explain whether those are weakenings and why those policies were removed.
I think, as you've alluded to, there is a certain amount of replication, not total. So I think the deletion of many of those policies is accounted for, but you're correct that they're not all fully accounted for. So that could be something that we can review to ensure everything that is currently contained within the Strategic Direction chapter is accounted for in the Urban Development chapter.
And can you, particularly while you're reviewing that, please refer to those first bullet points with regard to the words that were lost and why that might be so, and maybe that might be better, the original ones. And that goes on to the other ones, for instance, public and active transport networks have been dropped off the recreational community facilities. Now, 4.2.3.8. The land use within the NOS boundary or out of control boundary of the Queenstown Airport has managed to prohibit or limit a establishment of assets. In the in QAC's own submission, it pointed out that the VC 35 is actually stronger than the New Zealand standard on two fronts. One being that the standard did not said that Essence could be put in within an OCB as long as it was allowed within the district plan. And it also said that mechanical ventilation were not required within the OCB. Whereas we have, I gather, said both. So it's interesting to see this limit of Essence here, because my reading of the lower chapters is that, in fact, they're prohibited. I know in Franklin, for example, with the dental density that's allowed elsewhere in low density trees is not allowed in Franklin, and the medium density that had been initially proposed has been removed. So I'm just wondering, in terms of the overall RMA sustainable management of resources aim, whether continuing that greater protection of reverse sensitivity for the airport is justified, or whether, as you mentioned, there's already substantial capacity in Frampton area for residential, it's flat, it's sunny, whether the plan should actually look at this again and at PC 35 and how strongly those should come across, those provisions should come across, and if you can particularly please explain to me what you mean by prohibit or limit SNs there, where that might be reflected in policies.
Well, I guess there's options in terms of the regulatory response as to whether you prohibit SNs or whether you provide for them subject to certain mitigation factors such as acoustic insulation and so forth. So I guess that provides for some flexibility in approach, but essentially they're seeking to address what's a significant resource management issue. We'd need to have a look at the low order provisions and reconsider as a whole.
I don't quite understand, though, from your answer, why we haven't the strategic level to prohibit or limit establishment.
Would you want to delete limit?
Well, no, I don't. I just want to know, to me, in terms of overall use of the land, perhaps it could be wiser to have the greater residential development that, in fact, the NZ standard would allow us versus the tighter restrictions put on PC by PC 35. As far as I know, we haven't seen any Section 32 analysis on the economic costs of accepting Section 35 provisions over what the NZ standard insists on, especially considering QAC's own evidence says that current building standards would mean that within the OCB you can have a windows ajar and still meet the 40 billion limit, so i.e. it would be okay for an SN. So has there been that economic analysis of whether taking over the stronger provisions of PC 35 versus the NZ standard is just a justified resource management resource, especially considering your statements about the lack of affordable housing and that this would appear at first blush to be a good resource for it?
I think, you know, it's fair to say that we certainly have not brought over everything or close to everything from Plan Change 35, and you know, I understand that's obviously a concern from the airport. But, I mean, many of the provisions or approaches we have pulled across, and I guess we haven't challenged that from afresh. I guess these issues have been thrashed out in recent times. And that seems to have been a long-running and quite rigorous process. So
So there hasn't actually...
Pace, just looking at that policy and looking at the definition of activities sensitive to aircraft noise, is it possible that within that definition, notwithstanding the issue Commissioner Gilmore raised about intensification of residential use, that there are activities that the council may want to prohibit from being located within the air noise boundary of the airport, such as the outdoor spaces associated with daycare facilities, for example?
To be honest with you, I haven't worked on the lower order provision, so I think this is crossing over in terms of trying to understand what the lower order provisions are saying. I can't really comment on this without knowing those provisions in more detail. So.
There already are childcare centres with outdoor facilities with them.
That's not relevant.
Yeah, no, I'm just... but my question is more from the opposite perspective. Is it something that should actually, that we are in, within the plan, that the plan might be giving up potential to use a resource more intensively for instance, medium density housing with proper sound insulation than it would have if full...
I think limit covers that.
But that's my point. It says limit here, but where is the limit reflected in lower...
We'll get to that when we deal
with it. The map beneath that, has the Bridesdale been added to the UGB?
No, because the final decision hasn't been made.
True. So, thank you for that. Can you just explain, Mr. Bates, the logic of the Queenstown UGB extending out along the Covenant Golf Course and he's taking basically the donut of the, I think it's the ONF, out, because I don't think any of Jack's point actually, the resort is pretty much, resort zone is pretty much centred in that circular bit rather than going along the arm of the lake, isn't it? So would it be in a way more sensible to do as we have with like has a state shot of the country, do we have a disparate zone for Jackson rather than looking as if it might go across there?
So, just to clarify your question, so yep. Your concern
is... Can I just interrupt, because I think that's a mapping question, rather than... That map is only a reflection of the maps rather than the effects of the policies.
Okay. 4.2.4.1... The 6th bullet point. Further up in the chapter, you change Queenstown's town centre's key role to also include civic and cultural. Would it be wise to include that there also? Rather than just pluck two out of the four?
Possibly. Although I think read that policy as a whole, it is focused more on the economic and employment aspects, so limit the spatial growth of Queenstown so that the role of Queenstown Town Centre as the key tourism and employment hub is strengthened. I'm not saying what you're suggesting doesn't have merit, but I think the essence of this is looking more at economic factors, employment factors.
I can understand that that is the current focus, but I'm just querying whether that is necessarily correct and whether by holding it with those two words then you actually acknowledge the other purposes that you have previously acknowledged. Moving on, and it's related, 4242, ensured that development within the Queenstown UGB, and again, it's primarily economically provisioned, and there is nothing about the placemaking, the urban design, the livability of it that Mr. Bird referred to as essential to the Eslakai yesterday. Whereas Arrowtown does reflect on all that, and sure, it's a different character, but and again, Wanaka doesn't. It is, there's not much in the Nice to Live In front, and wondering, do you think it would be useful to ensure that actually the provisions that you had to refer to about development actually made all three places a nice place to live, that had some identity that held on to that genius loci that maybe isn't currently reflected?
So in terms of 4.2.4.2, I think there is some qualitative elements in that, and I think the third bullet point touches on what Mr. Bird was talking about in terms of the natural setting being critical. But
and I also said at that time that I think quite a few Queenslanders would feel perturbed if Queenstown's urban character was described purely in terms of its surrounding topography as opposed to its urban bookmark.
Yes, so certainly, I mean, there could be another bullet point that focuses more on the quality of the built environment, for example.
And I think the same as with
Wanaka. Yes.
Mr. Bird also said in his evidence several, four or five times that he could see the positives of UGB, but it could potentially have negative effects if there wasn't due regard given to urban design. And I asked if he felt that had been achieved, and his response was that he hadn't investigated it to that level. I asked specifically about whether design guidelines would be useful, and he said yes, and I see in the corporate plan that is going to happen, so that's great. I also asked about urban design panel. Is there, and he agreed that it would be useful to have that mandated to some level within the plan. Is it anywhere?
Mandating with the urban design panel?
Mm.
No, that's not provided for in the plan.
Do you think that it could be, or should be, or?
It could be. I don't know if it should be. I would need time to reflect on that and consider that. It's there as a very valuable forum, regardless of whether it's mandated in the district plan. So.
Have you had any submissions asking?
Yes, we have.
I suppose the more important question, Mr. Pates, is it a strategic issue or is it an implementation issue, the urban design panel?
It's an implementation issue, which if it was the current proposed system plan, I think would be in the lower order chapters in the case of a residential design guide.
Thank you. Last one on UGBs is, do you think we would be wise to have within the plan some kind of clarity as to how UGBs have been applied, therefore giving some guidance as to how they should be applied when the inevitable plan changes come in to ask for a change?
I know that there was at least one submission that sought additional policy, I think, that provided guidance around criteria that could be met to assist in decision-making around whether that plan change was appropriate. I see the logic in that argument. However, I don't necessarily support it. I think the danger is that it becomes a checklist, or you tick off the five criteria and there you go. As I said earlier, through the proposed district plan, I think we've enabled considerable capacity within the urban growth boundaries, and as I also said, there is flexibility within the proposed plan to reconsider that in the future. So there's flexibility, but I think it's dangerous to be setting things up too far in terms of contemplating the amendment.
Which is why I worded it the way I did, which was rather than, to give the explanation of how the UGBs as they will be defined were met, how, what grounds they were met with and were they met. So justification passed rather than necessarily going forward, but it would give you some reference point without being a checklist.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So I just want to clarify something. I had a bit of a brain freeze earlier. I just want to correct an error.
Yeah, sure.
I apologise. I think I advised you that the urban development chapter was only about the urban areas, and only areas with urban growth boundaries. That is wrong. It's primarily about urban areas, and urban growth boundaries is a tool. But of course, the first paragraph of the purpose makes reference to smaller urban townships. Now, I think it's fair to say that Objective 4.2.1 and associated policies are more wider and potentially general in their application than the urban growth boundaries, and that the chapter then goes on, obviously, to focus on urban growth boundaries as a tool. So just thought I'd clarify that. Apologise for that.
So in the light of that, would you like to go back to
4215
and give us your opinion on the purpose and meaning of that policy with or without the amendments?
Yes. So, yes, on reflection, I believe that's intended to also apply to townships, which, of course, don't have urban growth boundaries, at least at this point in time. So.
And so you see the deletion of or immediately adjacent to as focusing development in those smaller townships within the townships themselves?
Yes, that's right. I would still stand by my comment that Stage 2 needs to properly consider the issues of the townships, but yes, at this point in time, that's the intent.
So in regard to those existing settlements that don't have the UGVs, that would be the current zoning for...
That's right, the township zoning for those townships, essentially.
Thank you.
So this policy would not contemplate urban development outside of that township zoning.
So it's, the council isn't contemplating any extension to any of the existing settlements?
I think we would need to reserve judgment until Stage 2.
Right.
And I know at least one of the communities has said to me in my previous role in council that they really wanted to have strong community involvement in the process. So it's a process that we need to work through.
Commissioner Cox,
not a lot. Just a pretty high level thing. It's really relating to strategic direction back on the 3.2.1. And then they're talking about the different year change from central business areas to town centres, the description of the areas. I just know, for example, the Woolerich submission going on about it, because we've got the significant development going on at three parks. Have you got any thoughts on, I understand why we're concentrating and the support for concentrating on the town centres, but have you got any comment about, I didn't see any comment you made about that submission or their submission?
So yes, I mean, the focus of these policies is on the town centres proper. We of course have other policies relating to other centres which is a generic reference to other centres, such as that centre, such as Arrow Town and so forth, local shopping centres, because those centres are important as well. But the policies under Objective 3.2.1.1 are focused on the town centres themselves, so I would stand by retention of that approach. As I say, those other centres are covered further down. So.
Can I just follow on from that? I'm just wondering that I know that Three Parks hasn't been built, but from what I see, the contemplated development is not too dissimilar to Shotover Park and perhaps some of the 5 Mile development. And I'm just wondering whether that really falls into that local shopping centre category that the other submissions deal with. And I suspect that's what Willow Ridge will suggest to us, that it should be given equal status with Franklin Flats.
Yes, well, as I say, at the moment there is, you know, there is another policy that relates to the other centres, and it's not specific. And one could say that that's relegating, you know, the importance of those centres. I wouldn't see it that way. I mean, I think we need to give preeminence to major town centres. We haven't ignored the other centres. Of course, though, some parties will argue that greater emphasis needs to be given to those. Perhaps explicit mention needs to be made in those other centres.
I just got a real quick one on the one that was raised before about avoid non-industrial activities not related to sporting. I mean, the one that came up in the past was, so would you envisage then a like a caretaker's flat residential type, that little in industrial area, based on that or not? That's one thing we've struck in the past, trying to keep residential out of industrial. What was your thinking there? Would that be?
Well, that's crossing over the lower order chapters again, but it's a fair question because these naturally go to the lower order things. But I mean, generally speaking, we would want to discourage residential activity.
Wouldn't it? And then I guess it's the issue of the infrastructure. Someone's raised that when we talk about roading, do we, and when your sense of roading, we include bridges? Because when we're talking reasonably significant bridges.
I personally would consider bridges within roading infrastructure.
One follow-up, anticipating as the chair has foresight, expecting where the submitters will come from in relation to Three Parks. We discussed earlier the complementary nature of the relationship between Queenstown Town Centre and Frankton. If you were going to recognise Three Parks, would it be possible to come up with descriptions of the two centres of the Three Parks and Wanaka Town Centre that would in fact be different in any meaningful way? Are they just one big centre or will be when Three Parks is built?
I would consider them to be still quite distinct centres and quite different functions, I would anticipate, in terms of what anticipated to occur at Three Parks. So no, I definitely see the distinction as being important. And I guess, you know, that's one of the things we've tried to do with some of the recommended changes is try to flesh out what some of those key functions and qualities of the town centres are, such as the community, civic and cultural elements.
Thank you.
Looking at
3213. I take it from what you said before that that is an application to everything else in the district, other than the three that have previously dealt with now.
Yes.
Should the plan give some sort of indication where other business activity should go in a strategic sense, or just leave that for it to happen by chance?
I guess the objective as worded is focused on existing centres outside of the three big ones. So it's really relating to existing centres.
Well, I was thinking in the policies giving effect to that, whether they should be giving some indication as to where they go, or is it wherever someone chooses to apply for a plan change or a consent?
It's a good question. Well, I mean, you're right, at the moment there's no direction provided. I guess our focus in this policy framework is to ensure where those new locations might be do not have a detrimental impact on the viability and function of the existing centres. So that's been the primary consideration.
The other question on page 3.3 of that section, you've got in the policies that you've crossed out under objective 3.2.2.1, and I think it must be the last, it's the last policy, that further urban development of the district shall in rural settlements shall be located. Wondering why you've deleted that particular part where it's actually quite a high level. And I know there's some mention of it in chapter 4. Is that part of your reconsideration in terms of the urban growth boundary issue?
I think that it would be, I think if we're reconsidering having the urban growth boundaries as a policy in this location, it would be logical to reconsider that policy, given what I just said before about the urban development chapter being primarily about urban areas and urban growth boundaries, but not exclusively also being about small townships. So I think logically and from a consistency point of view, there would be merit in reconsidering that policy.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Sorry. I had imagined when you were responding to the same question before from me that you would keep those in Chapter 4 because you had said you didn't want to go down to the policy level within Chapter 3 and do something more along the lines of 3221, objective the third bullet point, to protect districts, rural landscapes from sporadic and spoiling development through the use of urban growth boundaries. So that is mentioning that's a policy without delving into the depth, which I agree with Commissioner Nugent, that is one of three that have been deleted, the whole bunch that would perhaps, going by your argument, be logical within Chapter 4 in terms of specificity of policy, as long as the overarching policy use of UGBs was in Chapter 3.
Just going to Chapter 4. Deleted, we're recommending deletion of policy 4233. I'm wondering whether it is good resource management practice to allow developable land to be used for low density development and to preclude the intensity that may be appropriate in the long term for that land. And I saw that policy as being useful in that sense.
I think one of the difficulties we had on reflection that was raised in with that policy is that if we've zoned an area for a certain intensity of development, is it not a bit problematic saying, well, perhaps the intensity of development in that zoned land should be lower than what we contemplated in the zoning? So, for example, if we have a rural residential zoning on the edge of the urban area, I think that policy is saying, well, perhaps development of that land should perhaps consider placement of lines and so forth to potentially enable some sort of intensification of the land. I mean, I still think the concept has merit, but I guess when we looked at it and we looked at the submission, we thought...
Couldn't it also apply, though, within the urban growth boundaries where you have greenfield areas at present, to ensure that they're not given over to effectively rural residential development, albeit that they may have a different zoning, when the long-term goal, as I see it, is to concentrate urban density of development on that land.
I think the other factor for us was that within the urban growth boundaries, there will be a diversity of demand for different forms of housing. And I guess we thought, well, it's not all about maximising densities. So an important element of the supply is that range of options from high density through to low density through to large lot residential. So that was another factor in us recommending the deletion.
The other question I have is more of a question of integrating Chapter 3 with Chapters 4 and 6. And I understand your logic of having, you know, the high-level objectives there. And I'm just wondering whether it may be appropriate where all the policies relevant, or all the means by which that objective is given effect to, are in the chapters 4 or 6, that there being an advice note or something directing people to the relevant objectives and policies that given that actually give effect to and implement that objective. And that might overcome the seeming gap between an objective there and then you have to go searching.
I think that's an approach while we're investigating use of marginal notes or footnotes to pull that connection together in a more explicit fashion.
Hopefully we
haven't left you too many. I think I was put last for a purpose. That's possibly to shorten my time rather than yours, Mr. Pames. The other thing I'll try to do is to keep it fairly high level since there's other bits coming back to us. You were here when Mr. Colgraves gave his evidence. Just in terms of where he was referring to the relationship between the projected growth in population and then the provisions made within the UGBs, how have you translated the information data banks that he came up with into the determination of the UGBs?
So, I mean, we worked back from the population projections, and the projections were for growth to 55,000 people in 2031. And the dwelling capacity model was a pretty important tool in terms of our evidence base and the development of the policy. So, when we were considering urban growth boundaries, we looked at all the existing zonings, greenfield zonings, special zones, and what their capacity is. And we looked at that relative to the population growth projections. And we also looked at what the proposed upzonings and the proposed plan would roughly potentially deliver. And we looked at realistic capacity rather than theoretical capacity. And we certainly wanted to have some fat in the system rather than trying to closely match capacity with population projections, just given the reality of parties or landowners not necessarily developing for whatever reason. So there was certainly a reasonable consideration given to those factors.
How do the UGBs relate to if you're providing for the 10-year life of the plan, which is when you have to do a review by? How does the UGBs relate to the population growth, how much land there is within the 10-year period of the plan?
So we looked at it more from a 15 to 20-year prospect. So in terms of the 15 to 20-year prospect, we think we're very well catered for in terms of capacity, which implies that over the 10-year period, Redmond better catered for. So, our work suggests that we've got more than twice the capacity relative to the projections of population growth. So, and as I say, the dwelling capacity factored in discounts to try and make it realistic. So,
jumping around all over the place. Mr. Farrell, in his evidence, had suggested the water provision be addressed in a separate chapter, and I just wondered, seems to relate to structure of the plan rather than a particular chapter. Do you have a view on that?
I don't particularly have a strong view either way.
No.
I would have to give some more thought to that.
In terms of how the biodiversity provisions within the plan are included, what does the RPS signal to the district councils, city councils within this region? Who's responsible for what in terms of biodiversity?
I don't know the proposed RPS. Sorry, are you talking about the operative or the
proposed?
Either. I don't know the proposed RPS in great detail. Certainly there's a reasonably strong focus, I'm aware of, the proposed RPS on up here sort of has sort of some tables or some sections of the plan that sort of seek to prescribe sort of responsibilities to different organisations or levels of governance. I couldn't tell you precisely what those requirements are. But certainly they place some emphasis and we've tried to carry that through in the policy sense.